The Last Viracocha begins as what looks at first like a polished archaeological thriller. A gifted young scholar, a secretive philanthropic foundation, and a remote Mayan site in Belize that seems to promise the usual scholarly excitement of hidden temples, buried chambers, and lost inscriptions. But Douglas Schofield steadily widens the frame until the novel becomes something much larger and stranger. A first contact science fiction story in which the ruins of the ancient Americas turn out to be linked to the fate of human civilization itself. At the center of that expansion is Yves Barcelon, a brilliant archaeologist whose ability to notice structure where others see clutter makes her uniquely capable of seeing the truth hidden in plain sight. Around her is a web of concealment, her parents' false names, the Cetus Foundation's pleasant public face, the military's covert investigation, and the ancient clues that point toward a reality no ordinary human science can comfortably absorb. The story opens in an Arizona bar, the Whiskey Roundup, with Eve already established as someone who watches more carefully than she speaks. The bar is noisy, half saloon and half social theater, and Eve is there not to flirt, but to observe. She is known enough by the bartender, Sully, that he has christened her the Channel Surfer, a nickname that captures her habit of scanning the room and mentally sorting the people in it. This opening scene does more than introduce her personality. It shows her as someone whose mind is always pattern matching, always looking for hidden significance. That trait is not just social intuition. It is the same mental habit that will later allow her to read ruins, notice anomalies, and eventually recognize that her own life has been built on concealment. From the bar, the novel moves into the first major catalyst, a meeting between Eve and Blake Milner, chairman of the Cetus Foundation. Milner appears in a luxurious helicopter at the Belize dig site, and the contrast between the rough heat of the jungle and the coldly polished interior of the aircraft immediately signals that Cetus is not an ordinary charitable sponsor. Milner presents the foundation as climate-minded philanthropy, interested in archaeology only insofar as it helps explain how environmental decline can destroy societies. That explanation sounds reasonable and even admirable, but there are already hints that Cetus knows more than it says. Milner wants Eve specifically. He has researched her prodigious academic rise, knows that she finished her degrees at astonishing speed, and is prepared to send her to a newly discovered site in western Belize, with only one student, under a strict non-disclosure agreement. The secrecy is unusual, and Eve correctly senses that there are strings attached. Even so, the offer appeals to her intellectual hunger. Back in Boston, the book shifts to Eve's domestic life and reveals the emotional strain behind her competence. On her birthday, her mother Nicole tries to celebrate, but the dinner becomes a confrontation. Eve has long suspected that her parents are lying to her about their lives, and she finally confronts them directly. Her father, Andreas, is always away on supposedly complicated work involving UNESCO and the return of looted antiquities, yet his passport is under a different name, Andreas Cato, and tied to the Sovereign Military Order of Malta. Eve's suspicion grows into outright anger. She asks whether she was adopted, then, with increasing bitterness, whether she is even their daughter at all. Nicole insists that she is their natural child, but the evasiveness only deepens Eve's sense that something fundamental has been hidden from her. At the same time, the novel roots this private family conflict in a larger public crisis. The television news reports catastrophic drought in Australia, deadly heat in India, and worsening climate collapse around the world. Eve doesn't want to think about it, but Nicole insists that the crisis will affect her life directly. That claim proves prophetic. Eve's visit to Belize begins as a standard dig, but the site quickly reveals itself to be unusual. Marie Rambourin, the student she selects, proves to be intelligent, observant, and fully capable of matching Eve's rigor. The relationship between the two women becomes a strong thread in the novel. Marie is herself a scientist and historian, shaped by a difficult academic environment, especially as a woman of color, in institutions still marked by bias and male dominance. Her frustrations with a department head who belittles her work mirror Eve's own experience of being underestimated, and the two form a practical, mutually respectful partnership. The Belize site is not merely a set of ruins, it behaves like a puzzle. Eve's exceptional intellect is central here. She studies stone walls, tests alignments, spots anomalies, and calculates massive weights in her head. A wall of interlocking polygonal blocks reminds her of Incan construction and the famous ancient astronaut speculation, though she immediately grounds the thought in real engineering. Marie discovers jade objects, and together they infer the presence of a burial site. Eve notices a pectoral, recognizes its significance, and decides to push deeper than the official scope of the exploratory mission. The work is methodical, but the atmosphere grows increasingly uncanny, as if the site is arranged to respond to her. A hurricane then descends on the team, forcing them into a hotel basement in Belize City. The storm works on multiple levels in the narrative. It is a literal threat, reflecting the climate instability the novel keeps returning to, and it is also a pressure mechanism that tightens the plot and brings hidden forces into collision. The team shelters in the Grand Vista Hotel, where Grady, Milner's assistant, lightens the tension with Belizean rum and comic relief. The storm also coincides with the first open sign that Eve and her parents are being watched. Major General Richard Croft, who once owed his life to Nicole, arrives at her house in a state of emotional turmoil and warns her that the Cetus Foundation has attracted dangerous intelligence attention. He tells her that factions within the DIA and a foreign intelligence service are investigating Cetus, that Eve and Nicole are listed as persons of interest, and that she should distance herself from the Foundation. His warning is serious, but he does not yet understand what he is looking at. He only senses that the people he is tracking are not what they appear to be. Meanwhile, the dig itself begins to open outward into a larger architecture. After the storm, Eve and Marie continue the excavation and discover more impossible structures, a dry depression, a precise drainage basin, and hidden stonework suggests something beneath the visible ruin. Eve's instincts tell her the site is part of something much larger than a single city. She recognizes the signature of a concealed chamber. Then, in one of the novel's most important moments, she encounters the first direct evidence that her own life is changing. At home, after receiving a mysterious note from her mother and an ATM card, Eve reaches for a bread knife and finds that it moves into her hand without touch. Then a coaster rises at her command. She realizes she can manipulate objects by thought. Her parents' cryptic music box, her mother's promise that Milner will guide her through her awakening, and the strange note all start to make sense. She is not merely learning a secret, she is becoming aware of her own nature. As Eve and Brady flee the increasingly dangerous investigation, the military and intelligence plot intensifies. Captain Jansen, leading the official investigation, is reckless, arrogant, and driven by fear. He and his team pursue Nicole and the broader Cetus web with escalating aggression, and their methods collide with real evidence in a way they do not understand. DNA analyses from the Belize jawbone and from samples connected to Nicole, the burned-out car wreck, and Eve's hair all produce a nucleotide count that cannot belong to a human. This forensic shock is one of the book's most important pivots. The military can no longer explain what it has found in conventional terms. Jansen wants to suppress the implications, but General Croft, increasingly appalled by the rogue operation, begins to realize that what he has in front of him is not a routine intelligence problem, but a profound ontological crisis. The evidence says that the Barcelons are not human. Eve and Grady's flight across the United States becomes both a literal chase and a journey into self-knowledge. The Porsche her mother left her is discovered to have an astonishing range and an apparently self-sustaining battery system. Another hint that her parents are not merely eccentric or secretive, but technologically and biologically extraordinary. While they drive south in disguise, Eve continues to experience her abilities, and the book uses these episodes to confirm that the awakening is real. She can lift objects, move them, and alter the physical world in ways that exceed ordinary human biology. At the same time, the military closes in, and Grady is revealed as Lieutenant Aykroyd, a planted intelligence operative. His apparent role as Cetus assistant has been part of the surveillance net all along, and Eve's trust is again broken. The turning point comes at Moray in Peru, where the narrative shifts from archaeological puzzle to off-world gateway. Moray, with its concentric depressions and hidden chamber, has the feeling of an ancient ceremonial site. But under Eve's precise attention, it becomes a machine of revelation. After rain exposes the hidden drainage pattern, she identifies the movable slab and descends into a concealed chamber. There, pursued by Neufeld and aware that soldiers may be closing in, she enters a citrine doorway and finds herself in a vast underground complex. The space opens into a glowing corridor, led by a cheetah named Penna, whose presence already indicates that the world she is entering is not bound by ordinary earthly categories. Inside, she is greeted not by her living parents, but by memorations, advanced apparently holographic or AI-like constructs containing the preserved consciousness of Andreas and Nicole. This is one of the book's deepest emotional turns. Eve learns that her real parents died in a collision while being pursued by soldiers, and that these memorations were prepared to activate only when she reached awakening. They explain that she is not human at all. She belongs to a species called Thalassans, though Viracocha is the Earth name for their kind. They came to Earth long ago, perhaps arriving from a planet called Thalassa in the Tau Ceti system, and have lived among humans while hidden. Their biological similarity to humans is no accident, but the result of parallel evolution, or perhaps seeding by some greater agency. Their brains differ fundamentally from human brains. Fused neural networks, rapid maturation, faster healing, and a capacity to manipulate matter through focused thought, described as coherent electromagnetic influence arising from disciplined consciousness. Eve's powers are therefore not supernatural, but an expression of advanced physiology and cognition. The revelation continues to widen. Thalassa is a carefully maintained world, environmentally protected in contrast to Earth, and the Thalassan species has observed humanity for a long time. They are not random visitors. They are custodians and planners. The immediate reason for Eve's mission is urgent. Earth is collapsing, and the Thalassans have selected hundreds of children with exceptional promise to be rescued and transported to a prepared settlement world. Eve, because she spent so many years unaware of her own identity, is uniquely positioned to act as humanity's final guide. She understands human culture from within, yet she now possesses the knowledge of her own people. The mission is not to save Earth itself, but to save a chosen portion of humanity from its ruin and begin again elsewhere. The moral complexity is strong. The Thalassans are compassionate, but they are also selective, secretive, and strategic. They will not simply open their world to humans. Trust must be earned. The final act resolves the military pursuit through a combination of betrayal, extraction, and strategic reversal. Eve confronts Grady and the soldiers, confirms his treachery, and manages to survive long enough to complete the transition to the ship. Her parents' memorations explain that the hidden chamber and the broader rescue operation have been part of a long-surveilled plan. Earth's future has been watched because Thalassa has a duty to protect the planet's biosphere, even if humanity fails. If Earth's civilization collapses into nuclear catastrophe, Thalassan agents will be obliged to deactivate reactors before they can poison the atmosphere. In other words, the Thalassans are not passive observers. They are emergency custodians of a civilization they do not fully trust. The epilogue finally turns to the future. It does not simply end with Eve's departure. Instead, it extends the story to Marie and Sule, two humans whose lives were altered by the same hidden history. Marie, after being marginalized at Harvard, built a career in Trinidad. Sule, after witnessing the Moray events, dedicated himself to peace work at the United Nations, but was ridiculed and eventually pushed out. Together, with Eve's intervention, they marry, have twin daughters, and eventually join her in the new settlement world. Eve addresses the assembled community on Earth too, introducing them and explaining that Earth's condition is catastrophic. The final image is cosmic and hopeful at once, Tau Ceti shining over the horizon, the new world completing another orbit, and a human future continuing under Thalassan guidance. The novel closes where it began to point, with discovery, but the scale has changed completely. What began in a bar, at a dig, and in a family argument becomes a meditation on origin, identity, ecological responsibility, and the possibility that the last refuge of humanity may depend on understanding that we were never as alone as we thought.